Roy Halladay was one of the greatest pitchers to ever take the mound. A career defined by a mind-blowing work ethic, competitiveness, and resilience. Halladay was awarded the Cy Young Award twice and voted to the All-Star team 8 times. When Halladay took the mound, he owned it. Outside of his family, Halladay loved 2 things, pitching and airplanes. Pitching made Halladay who he was and provided everything he ever wanted. Tragically, an airplane took it all away. I'm Nina Instead, and this is Deadball.
It's a base hit. It's a 1-0.
You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom
ball game over.
Born Harry Leroy Halladay III on May 14, 1977, in Denver, Colorado, to Father Roy and Mother Linda, he was one of 3 children along with his sisters Heather and Miranda. Father, Roy Halladay Jr., was a commercial pilot who shared his love of planes and aviation with young Roy. The two spent time together building and painting model airplanes. Doing this takes patience, organization, and a meticulous sensibility, not unlike being a professional pitcher. Both require starting with individual parts and putting them together just right to create something beautiful. Halladay attended Arvada West High School, where he excelled as a pitcher and was named the Colorado High School Player of the Year in 1994. He was drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays in the first round of the 1995 MLB draft, rising quickly through the ranks of the organization's minor league system. Halladay made his major league debut in 1998, facing the Devil Rays at Tropicana Field. Randy Wynn was the first batter to come to plate, and Halladay sat him down on strikes. He threw for 5 innings of 3 runs with no decision. Halladay was set for a win until Fred McGriff hit a game-tying home run in the 9th inning. Nicknamed Doc by Blue Jays announcer Tom Cheek as a reference to the famous gunslinger and friend of Wyatt Earp. Just 7 days later, Halladay made his 2nd career start on the final day of the regular season. Halladay took a no-hitter into the 9th inning until Tigers pinch hitter Bobby Higginson lifted a solo home run into the stands. Halladay finished with a one-hitter, a complete game, and the first win of his career. His career was not without difficulty. Halladay's 2000 season saw a 10.64 ERA and 2.2 WHIP. Every good baseball career requires adversity. Being great with no struggle makes for a dull story. The Blue Jays sent Halladay to the minors to work with coach Mel Queen. While there, Halladay adjusted his delivery to a 3/4 arm angle. This led to his trademark sinker. Coach Queen saw that making the minor adjustment would add depth to his repertoire, and his was spot on. Halladay never lost his confidence or his work ethic, and he continued to improve his mechanics and mental approach to the game. Some people just don't get jarred. They can take all the stress in and remain focused. 2002 was a breakout season. He won 19 games and earned his first of 8 All-Star appearances. This was the infamous game that ended in a tie, as if Commissioner Bud Selig needed any help with bad press. Halladay came into the game in the bottom of the 3rd. He gave up 3 runs on 3 hits, including a 2-run homer to Barry Bonds. It wasn't the best of outings, and I'm sure Roy was not happy, but he was just starting his story. 2003 was a monstrous year for Halladay. He threw a 10-inning shutout against the Tigers at the Sky Dome in Toronto and earned his first Cy Young Award that year. Halladay finished with a 22-7 record and a 3.25 ERA. He threw over 6 strikeouts for every walk. One impressive record that Halladay holds to this day is that in 2007, he threw another 10-inning complete game against the Tigers. This is the last 9-plus inning in the majors as of the recording of this episode. Halladay established himself as one of the best pitchers in the game. He was durable, had impeccable location, and was always willing to pitch deep into games. The 2009 Blue Jays finished fourth in the AL East with a 75-87 record. This led to the firing of general manager J.P. Riccardi, who was replaced by assistant general manager Alex Anthopoulos. Halliday was staring down the barrel of his 12th season. He was still one of the best, but his body was beginning to show wear and tear. He knew his time was limited in the bigs. Halliday wanted to make a move to a club he believed had a shot at making a postseason run. So he called a meeting with team ownership and his agent. Blue Jays president Paul Beeston, Mr. and Mrs. Halliday, and his agent laid out what he wanted over a dinner get-together. He presented his wants and explained plainly that he was not going to re-sign with Toronto. He wanted a trade. Doing so would be best for the Blue Jays, as they would at least receive traded players for Halliday. Author Todd Zalecki wrote in his book Doc, The Life of Roy Halliday, what Halliday said in the meeting. "Look, if you guys are rebuilding, my clock is getting short," Halliday said. "I don't know how long I have, and I don't want to go through another rebuilding process. I would love nothing more than to win a World Series championship in Toronto, but I don't know that I have the time. So I would really prefer that you guys would push me to one of these two teams." The teams Halliday was referencing were the 2008 World Champion Phillies and the 2009 World Champion Yankees. He did not care which of these teams were chosen. Whichever worked best for the Blue Jays, he would be happy with. Halliday had a no-trade clause and just 1 year remaining on his contract. If Toronto did not trade him, he would have been a free agent, and Toronto would have missed out. After back-and-forth conversations for months between ownership, management, agents, and Roy and his wife, a deal was finally struck. But the day of the trade did not come without its own scuttlebutt as to what players were all involved. At first, it was thought of as a three-way deal, with Halliday going to Philadelphia, Cliff Lee heading to Seattle, and the Blue Jays getting Philippe Almont and Dominic Brown. Soon, after more speculation, J.A. Happ was among the players headed to Toronto. Also, Michael Saunders was said to be involved. At last, the final details emerged. It turned out that instead of a three-way exchange, the Phillies were involved in two trades. First, picking up Halliday from Toronto and sending Cliff Lee to Seattle for Philippe Almont, Tyson Gillies, and Juan Ramirez. For Blue Jays fans, this trade is regarded as one of the worst in team history, and while that may be true, what choice did Toronto have? Halliday was exercising his no-trade clause and was refusing to re-sign at the end of his contract. The Blue Jays did their best to make chicken salad out of chicken, well, you know. Halliday left Toronto with many impressive stats. Second in Blue Jay history in wins with 148, second in strikeouts with 1,495, and third in complete games with 49. Then it was on to the city of brotherly love. Halliday would change out his number 32 jersey from Toronto for number 34 with the Phillies, as 32 had been worn by Steve Carlton and had been retired by the team. In his Phillies press conference, Halliday said, "I want to start by thanking everyone in Toronto, the fans, the organization, the people. It was a big part of my life and something I will never forget." He went on to say, "I am extremely excited about a new chapter and having this opportunity to be part of such a great organization, somewhere that me and my family are really looking forward to be part of." 2010 was truly a magical season for Roy Halliday. He won his second Cy Young Award that year and, in two very special games, put on what can only be described as a God mode performance. Fans for Philadelphia and the opposition alike watched in amazement. May 29th, 2010 was a hot day in Miami. The mercury hovered around 88 degrees when Halliday took the mound at Sun Life Stadium to face the Marlins. Halliday had 10 starts with a 6-3 record and a 2.22 ERA coming into the game. The Phillies were 27-20 for the season, but on a bit of a slide, losing the last 7 of 10 games. Perfect games aren't something fans, announcers, or even the pitcher sees coming until late in the game. For it to happen, all the ingredients need to come together just right. A perfect game is as delicate as baked Alaska, but when finished, it's just as sweet and delicious. Halliday had 7 three-ball counts. He hung on to his perfect game by his fingernails. Undaunted, he continued to pound the strike zone. Heading into the 8th inning after retiring 24 batters, Halliday had only gone that long without giving up a hit just once prior in his career. In 1998, as a Blue Jay against the Tigers, when he went 8.2 innings. The difference? A perfect game was not on the line. In the 9th inning, Will Omen was the first to step in. On a 2-1 fastball, Omen lifted the ball to deep center. Shane Victorino made the catch at the warning track for out number 1. Wes Helms was up next, and everyone could feel the pressure rising. The fans were sensing it, and Halliday's teammates did not want to let him down. On a 1-2, 93-mile-an-hour fastball on the inside, Helms watched it go by for strike 3, number 11 on the day for Halliday. Catcher Ronnie Polino was third to the plate in the inning. The count was 1-2. While the fans were not of the hometown variety, witnessing a perfect game is rarer than seeing almost any achievement in sports. The coaching staff were holding their breath and all eyes were on Halliday. Halliday threw the ball up and away. Polino hit it to about halfway between second and third. Charging third baseman Juan Castro scooped the ball, spun around, and fired to first base for the 27th out. It was the second perfect game in Phillies history and the second of the 2010 season, the first being from Dallas Braden of the Oakland Athletics. What began as a hostile Miami crowd of 25,000 turned into a standing ovation for Halliday and his achievement. I don't know what to say. Early in my bullpen warm-up, I was hitting spots more than I have been. I felt like I just carried that out there, Halliday said. Halliday sang high praise for his catcher, Carlos Ruiz. We felt like we got in a groove early, and about the 5th or 6th, I was just following Chooch, he said. I can't say enough about the job he did today. Mixed pitches. For me, it was really a no-brainer. The Phillies would go on to clinch the National League East with a 97-65 record, setting up a clash with the National League Central champion Cincinnati Reds, who finished the regular season 91-71. The Reds had the best OPS in the National League that season at .790 and a National League best 1,515 hits. Joey Votto was the tip of their offensive spear with a .324/.424/.600 slash line. He led the Reds to be the offensive powerhouse they were. No one wanted to face their lineup. But I guess Roy Halliday didn't get the memo. On October 6th, the Reds traveled to Philadelphia to begin the postseason at Citizens Bank Park in front of 46,411 fans. Phillies ace Roy Halliday was on the mound, making his first ever postseason appearance. From the moment Halliday walked out of the dugout and threw his first warm-up pitch, he owned the Reds. Joey Votto grounded out in each of his 3 at-bats. Third baseman Scott Rolen struck out in all 3 of his plate appearances. Only 4 hits from the Reds made it to the outfield. Halliday struck out 8 batters with a total of 79 strikes out of 104 pitches. The only at-bat which kept Halliday from his second perfect game of the season was a 5th-inning walk to Jay Bruce. With the capacity crowd on their feet, Halliday took the mound to face the bottom of the Reds' order in the 9th. Ramon Hernandez popped out to chase Utley. Pinch hitter Miguel Cairo, who played for the Phillies the previous season, hit a pop foul to third baseman Wilson Valdez. Brandon Phillips was up next. The top of the order would need to start the comeback if the Reds were getting out of this one. The crowd was electric, and the cheers were deafening. Phillips had been to the plate three times prior, which ended in a ground out to short, a looking strikeout, and a fly ball to right. Halliday was not timid and came right at Phillips with a 93-mile-an-hour fastball on the outside corner for strike one. Halliday had thrown a first-pitch fastball to 24 of the previous 27 batters. Phillips should have been looking for that fastball. Halliday came right back with a 91-mile-an-hour fastball again on the outside corner, a little lower than the first pitch. Phillips took a cut and missed. The Philadelphia faithful waved their white towels in a fervor. They were one out away. On the 0-2 pitch, Phillips grazed the ball, knocking it in front of the plate. Catcher Carlos Ruiz snatched the ball and, from his knees, fired to first baseman Ryan Howard to end the game and cement Halliday's no-hitter. Fireworks erupted and his teammates met him at the mound for high fives and hugs. It was the second no-hitter in postseason history, the first since 1956 when Don Larsen of the Yankees threw a perfect game against the Brooklyn Dodgers. In a post-game, on-the-field interview, Halliday said being in the company of Don Larsen, "Well, it's surreal. It really is. I just wanted to pitch in the postseason, and to be able to go out and have a game like that, it's a dream come true." Halliday played his final game on September 23, 2013, against the Miami Marlins at Marlins Park in front of 18,627 fans. Halliday lasted one out into the first inning. He walked Donovan Solano and Christian Yelich before being taken out of the game by manager Ryne Sandberg. Even the greats have off days. December 9, 2013 was Halliday's final day as a professional baseball player. Wanting to leave the game he loved as part of the team where it all began, he signed a one-day contract with the Blue Jays. "As a baseball player, you realize that's something you can't do the rest of your life," Halliday said at his retirement press conference. "I really don't have any regrets." Halliday finished his career with a record of 2.03-1.05 and an ERA of 3.38. He struck out 2,117 batters and walked just 592. Halliday threw 67 complete games and 20 shutouts. By the estimation of many pundits, players, and fans, Halliday was a lock for the Hall of Fame. His accomplishments did not stop when he stepped off the diamond. The Halliday Family Foundation gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to children's charities, hunger relief, and animal rescues both during and after his career. Halliday's philanthropy led to multiple nominations for the Roberto Clemente Award. This award is given by Major League Baseball to players for sportsmanship and community involvement. Halliday was nominated several times. Tuesday, November 7th, 2017, started as any other day. Roy and his wife Brandy took their boys to school that morning and planned to see their son Ryan play in a school band concert that afternoon. Before that, Brandy planned to run errands with her mother. She asked Roy if he wanted to join them. They could run errands, have lunch, and spend the day together. But Roy said he had other things he needed to do and declined the invitation. Brandy went on with her day, planning her stops accordingly so she could be back in time for her son's concert. Family was important. She and Roy were always there for their kids. Roy texted Brandy a bit later. He said he planned to fly his plane from the lake to the airport and then drive the Jeep they kept there back to see his son performed. He texted again, "I'm so sorry. I feel like you're upset with me. I should have just gone with you." In an interview, Brandy said, "He struggled a lot with depression. He struggled a lot with anxiety, social anxiety. He never felt like he was good enough or funny enough or liked. He was a sad spirit. But I don't want that to overshadow all the great times." Halliday took his Icon A5 airplane, a light sport aircraft that is capable of landing on the water, for a spin off the west coast of Florida over the Gulf of Mexico. Halliday was the only person on board when his plane crashed into the water shortly after noon off Newport Richey. There were no distress calls from Halliday to air traffic control. Halliday had always loved airplanes. From his model airplane days with his father and then obtaining his pilot's license after retirement, planes were a love of his. A few weeks earlier, Halliday posted to Twitter with a point-of-view video flying his A5 with the caption, "Can't begin to explain all the breathtaking views I have seen through the open windows of demos and now my very own Icon A5. Sheriff Chris Noko said of Halliday, "He loved to fly. He talked about his family, baseball, and flying." In another social media post, Halliday talks about his new plane with his wife and says his baseball contract did not allow him to have a pilot's license, and now that he's retired, even his wife Brandy was against it. "She fought me the whole way," Halliday said. "Hard. I fought hard. I was very against it," Brandy Halliday said in the same video, before explaining why she eventually understood and approved of her husband's desire to have the plane. Both the Blue Jays and Phillies released statements of Halliday's passing. "Our organization was overcome by grief with the tragic loss of one of the franchise's greatest and most respected players, but even better human being. Impossible to express what he has meant to this franchise, the city, and its fans. We are numb over the very tragic news about Roy Halliday's untimely death. There are no words to describe the sadness that the entire Phillies family is feeling over the loss of one of the most respected human beings to ever play the game." Halliday took off at 11:47 a.m. He climbed to a little more than 1,900 feet, flying north for about 4 miles before turning west. He texted his wife from the air saying not enough time to get to the airport. He said he would just fly home and drive from there. "I love you. Just get here," Brandy said. "I love you too. I'm sorry. I should have just gone with you. Another wasted day." Halliday crossed U.S. Route 19 at about 600 feet. He descended to 36 feet over the water, turning south. He flew past Green Key and made a 360-degree turn to the right and continued to fly south. The last airplane data had Halliday at 200 feet and flying at 100 miles an hour. The Icon A5 made another climb between 300 to 500 feet and another 45-degree nose-down maneuver before crashing into the Gulf of Mexico at 12:04 p.m. Brandy got to Ryan's school and texted him saying she was saving him a seat. As it got closer to 1 o'clock, she texted again. "Where are you? The show is starting in 5 minutes. You're supposed to be here." A few minutes into the concert, she texted again. "Where are you?" A girlfriend texted Brandy about 30 minutes into the concert. "Please tell me you're not flying today," she wrote. "A small plane crashed behind the house." "Roy was flying earlier, but he's not now," Brandy replied. "What kind of plane was it?" Her friend responded that she didn't know. Brandy told herself that it wasn't him. He probably just parked and was walking to the school. The concert ended, and he never showed. Brandy started to panic, but hoped maybe he just misplaced his phone. He was going to show up, she just knew it. Brandy's phone rang. She answered quickly, thinking it was Roy. It was Brandy's brother. He was at her house. "There's a sheriff here," he said, and he was crying. "He needs to talk to you," Brandy screamed. At that point, she knew. All of her hope of Roy's safety vanished in an instant. Brandy needed to be the first person to tell her boys that their father died. She was afraid news would travel fast and they would hear from someone else. Brandy confirmed the tail number of the aircraft to the sheriff. It was now official. A local TV station showed up in front of the Halliday house before Braden and Ryan got there. She asked the crew to leave. The reporter replied, "Ma'am, I'm sorry for your loss, but I have a job to do." The boys got home. They knew the worst had happened, as they had already heard from friends. Jimmy Rollins, who played with Halliday in Philadelphia, got the news in a text from Ryan Howard. Jimmy had spent his whole career playing with the Phillies. In a later interview, Jimmy said it didn't hit him until later that night when he crawled into bed and his wife kicked him in the leg. "It hit me that Brandy doesn't have this anymore," he said. "She doesn't say, 'Move over,' or 'Give me the pillow.' Their sons don't have their dad coming through the door and hearing his voice. That's when it really got heavy." A public funeral service was held on November 14th at Spectrum Field in Clearwater, Florida. The family felt the public deserved a place to grieve. A statement from the Hallidays read, "While we mourn the loss of the core of our family, we choose to celebrate him and remember the man we knew privately on and off the field. We hope that he serves as an example of professionalism, integrity, and hard work for all who knew him. For us, we will forever remember his unconditional love, humility, and the sacrifices he made to provide for the family that meant the world to him." The 2019 Hall of Fame class included Mariano Rivera, Edgar Martinez, Mike Messina, Lee Smith, Harold Baines, and posthumously, Roy Halladay. Halladay was elected with 85.4% of the vote. Reporter Hayden Godfrey of JaysJournal.com wrote, "For a man of class, dignity, and style, there is no higher honor than this one." The big decision for his family was which team Halladay would represent in Cooperstown, where it all began for him with Toronto, or where he had the most success, Philadelphia. The decision was not a difficult one. The bond the Hallidays felt with both cities made the choice impossible. Both clubs were part of their family. Brandy Halladay told the Denver Post, "There's no way to decide between the two teams, and I know we've spent the majority of our time in Toronto," Halladay's widow Brandy said in January. "Toronto gave us that chance, that base at the start, but Philly also gave us a chance to win and the passion that we wanted, and there's no way to choose, so we just decided that he'll go in with no team." There is no team logo on the cap of Halladay's Hall of Fame plaque. Best friend and former Toronto teammate Chris Carpenter spoke to those in attendance. He told some personal stories from the road and how they met. It was evident that Halladay was an important part of Carpenter's life. At times, it was hard for him to talk about his late friend. The time had come for what everyone in attendance had been waiting for, Brandy Halliday's speech. To be able to summon the strength and poise it takes to speak publicly in front of thousands of people is not an easy task. But Brandy felt she owed it to the fans, and of course to Roy. She approached the podium to a standing ovation, and emotion overtook her. "This is not my speech to give," she told the crowd. "I'm going to do the best I can to say the things I believe Roy might have said or would have wanted to say if he were here today. The thank yous could and should go on for days when you consider the impact so many people had on Roy's career." In the years since his death, Halladay's legacy has only grown. His incredible work ethic, his fierce competitiveness, and his love of family and community continue to inspire fans and players alike. He was a true icon of the game, and he will always be remembered as one of the greatest pitchers in MLB history. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dead Ball. To learn more about the podcast and connect with like-minded baseball fans, visit the Dead Ball Discussion Group on Facebook.
It's a base hit. It's a 1-0.
You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center.